surgical palliative care may seem counterintuitive, but surgeons have a rich history of palliating both their patients and their families. I am Red Hoffman, an acute care surgeon in Asheville, North Carolina, and one of 79 surgeons currently board certified in hospice and palliative medicine. Join me as I interview the founders and the leaders of the surgical palliative care movement, a diverse group of surgeons dedicated to providing high-quality palliative medicine to all surgical and trauma patients. Welcome to the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. We heal with more than steel. Hi, everyone. This is Red Hoffman. Welcome to another episode of the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. My host for today is Dr. Mackenzie Cook. Mac is an assistant professor of surgery in the Division of Trauma, Critical Care, and Acute Care Surgery at OHSU School of Medicine in Portland, Oregon. Mac, thanks so much for being with me today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Of course. And today, Mac and I are so excited to be speaking with Dr. Katie O'Connell. Katie is an assistant professor of surgery at University of Washington School of Medicine and is the director of surgical palliative care at Harborview Medical Center. Katie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you both so much for having me. I'm really excited to be on your podcast.
Thanks. So Mac actually suggested to me that we should do a podcast focused on COVID-19, how this virus is affecting the surgical community, and also how we as surgical palliative care providers may be helpful in this pandemic. So I wanted to just give a little bit of background. As of 6 o'clock this morning, according to the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center, there are 14,250 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the United States, with 205 confirmed deaths, 74 of which have been in Washington State. So, Katie, given that you are currently practicing in one of the epicenters of the virus, can you give us an overview of what's been going on in Washington State and in your hospital for the past several weeks?
Yeah, so this is really, it's been a day-to-day sort of process and has ramped up over the past couple weeks. And I think a lot of folks are contacting people from the University of Washington for guidance now because they're in other parts of the country that are anticipating they're going to be in the same spot in the next coming weeks as we are now. But essentially, a few weeks ago at the university, there was a group of multidisciplinary leaders, both at the university and at Harborview Medical Center, who formed what we call like the Incident Command Center. These people are essentially working tirelessly around the clock to perform like situational awareness, develop protocols, and keep all the UW Medicine members informed of the current status within our medical system. And what their focus has been, there's a central COVID protocol repository that's published on our institution's internet that details everything from environmental services cleaning protocols to PAPR hood reuse protocols and like code blue guidelines, everything. And it's available to all of us working in the medical system. It's constantly changing every day. We're getting updates from the leadership on what our status is at each of our UW Medicine hospitals in terms of patients who are currently positive, patients who are pending test results, resource availability, and sort of their planning process in terms of shifting resources and roles of certain providers. A lot of people are having to be flexible and start thinking kind of outside of the box in terms of ways to adapt to this new crisis.
So on about a week ago, on March 13th, the American College of Surgeons issued this recommendation that hospitals, health systems, and surgeons should review their scheduled elective procedures to basically minimize, postpone, and cancel scheduled operations to try to save human resources, to try to save PPE, and to try to save ICU and hospital beds for this coming surge. Red and Katie, how are your hospitals dealing with this? Are we following these guidelines?
So I work in Asheville, North Carolina for a for-profit institution. And I will say that on this past Monday, so several days after that came out, we got a letter saying that we are going to continue elective procedures for now. And the reasoning was that we have enough room and enough equipment and resources so we can. And, you know, what came up for me is that palliative care saying, just because we can doesn't mean we should. And I did feel in some ways that it kind of ignored that whole idea of, do we really need to be bringing people into the hospital now who may be carriers of the virus? Do we need to be exposing our workers to them? Do we need to be exposing these patients to other people who may potentially be carrying the virus? So it really brought up a lot of ethical concerns for me and for other people. I will say, I think as of this coming Monday, so when this podcast is being published, actually, my hospital is going to be stopping elective procedures. I understand the financial concerns, but I think that really it's the right thing to do. I was listening to The Daily yesterday, I think, and Governor Cuomo in New York State was just saying, like, and it was so true. He's like, if you're not alive, nothing else matters. I mean, that's kind of where we are. So I feel for a lot of my colleagues who are certainly paid based on production, mm-hmm. but I just think for right now, it's the right thing to do. So I'm glad to say that where I work is getting in line with that. What about you, Katie?
Yeah, so we received notice the end of last week, I believe. And so we started canceling or postponing our elective non-urgent cases as of Monday. And this has been challenging, especially for me as a new attending, because there's a couple different things that have come up. There's a lot of anxiety in making these decisions to postpone a surgery. First, because we don't really know how long this, you know, the impact of COVID is going to last. And two, most of these cases really have the potential for disease progression. And so some of these patients, you do worry, are they going to convert from an elective operation to a more urgent or emergent surgery? So that is definitely something that I think people are dealing with now. And I know myself and some of my junior partners are kind of bouncing ideas off of each other. Hey, what do you think about this? Do you agree that this patient can wait? But one of the things that I found helpful was the ACS recommended the elective surgery acuity scale published by Dr. Siddiqui at St. Louis University, which is just to really guide surgeons in sort of making these decisions. And it's kind of like this tiered based system that looks at both the combination of the acuity of surgery and the health of the patient. It just gave me a little bit of reassurance to kind of have some sort of framework for making these decisions.
I think it brings up the point to what is truly elective. In the public's mind, elective might be something, say, a breast augmentation, but that really in our world, it's not always black and white, that it is gray, that what may be considered elective right now in 4 weeks or in 8 weeks may end up being an emergent procedure or may end up causing someone to have a disease progression. And so I think it has been challenging on that level as well.
Yeah. You know, the unknown of how long we're going to be at this, I think is really, our hospital has designated a series of surgical triage officers who are, you know, senior level surgeons to basically provide that decision support to people. You know, like, is this actually elective? Can it be delayed? What's the implication? You know, the challenge is, you know, you got general surgeons making decisions about spine surgery and urologists, mm-hmm. You start to cross specialties and it gets very complicated very fast. Katie, this is probably, you know, dovetails with the palliative, how do you approach patients in that situation? How would you recommend approaching patients? You know, they've been getting geared up for a big operation or an operation that they think they need, and we have to call them and tell them that, sorry, it's not going to happen right now, or it may not happen for a month or 2 months or 6 months or who knows.
Yeah, that's really challenging for us. Some of our patients that are strictly elective operations, such as like inguinal hernia repairs, patients I feel comfortable having our patient care coordinators reach out to them mm-hmm. and explain the situation. For the few patients that I've had to cancel that are more complicated, I call the patients and speak with them myself to kind of explain what's going on. One of the things that I have found helpful is Vital Talk has published a short document on sort of how to respond to COVID-related issues from a palliative care standpoint, and that's mm-hmm. published on their website. And so it addresses some of these potential responses that we'll get as providers. You know, maybe people are frustrated, they're anxious, they're worried, and kind of go-to phrases of how to best navigate these conversations.
You know, that Vital Talks link has been immensely helpful. We've shared it amongst our ICU physicians here down in Portland, and hopefully we don't need it, but it's been very helpful in sort of how we're going to approach the coming mess.
Yeah, and I'll make sure to put that in the show notes because I have used it as well. I thought between the three of us, we could talk a little bit about what we feel like the role of surgical palliative care is during this pandemic. In my mind, there's several different opportunities for support that I thought we'd discuss. And the first I thought we could discuss is just the ongoing care of surgical patients, like our surgical patients who keep coming into the hospital. So certainly for us, our trauma patients and our emergency general surgery patients. And as the palliative care teams become overwhelmed, I think that surgeons are going to need to step up and provide more primary palliative care. And I certainly think as people who do palliative care, we are in a position to help our colleagues with this. One thing that I wanted to mention and that I'll certainly put in the show notes as well is that the Center to Advance Palliative Care, which is CAPC, has published some amazing free resources on their website to assist with all sorts of symptom management. So not just looking at end-of-life care, but looking at things that we would often call the palliative care team for, like nausea and vomiting in the setting of a malignant small bowel obstruction, dyspnea, which certainly not just COVID patients, but some of our other patients could be dealing with, crisis management for both the patients and the families. So that was certainly one way I was thinking we could support our surgical colleagues and kind of helping them come up to speed with their primary palliative care skills.
Yeah, it's going to be a bit of a challenge. You know, this is something that we do on a regular basis is, you know, trauma and acute care surgeons and intensivists. And it's really going to be a challenge to bring people who this isn't part of their daily life into the fold. Kate, have you guys had to do that yet, sort of like real-time train people or just-in-time train people to provide these complex primary palliative care?
We haven't yet, but I will say that the palliative care, the specialty palliative care team at Harborview has, in UW Medicine, has already developed and published sort of their plan for what the current state is and how they are triaging consults. Mm-hmm. And they broke it down by both in the emergency department on the acute care floor and also ICU. And then part of that plan is sort of like the surge state that's coming. And so they carefully outline how they are going to sort of reallocate their already scarce manpower. And one of the main points of that is to really help in guiding the primary services to be having these conversations on their own. I think one of the things that I experienced last week, I was on the trauma service and we noticed that our patients in the trauma ICU were waiting for like 3 days or so to get family meetings set up with the specialty palliative care service. And so they are already feeling this COVID impact because they're getting consulted on all these positive patients. What I proposed was in light of the fact that we have now drastically decreased our trauma admissions, we have canceled all of our general surgery clinics and we have postponed all of our elective surgeries. So for like the first time ever, surgeons' bandwidth is like drastically increased.
Everybody's bored.
I know, like, it's so weird.
Yeah.
Ourselves.
Yeah. And so I think people, you know, some people, especially the more senior people, are actively involved in like the incident command and all the planning processes. But for someone like myself, who is just in second year of attending, I tried to figure out a way to help. And we came up with an idea to create this sort of temporary surgical palliative care service. My partner, this is like a two-woman team. My partner is Andrea Gall, who's one of our outstanding nurse trauma coordinators at Harborview. But we have joined forces to provide palliative care services to our surgical ICU patients. And that is, one, to kind of prioritize their palliative care needs during this whole crisis, but also to offload the consults from the specialty palliative care service that is kind of getting inundated and trying to figure out how to triage appropriately.
You know, Katie, you said something a little earlier that kind of raised a question in my mind. You know, one of the things we try to do in people who are admitted to the ICU, particularly trauma patients who are admitted to the ICU, is have our first family meeting or goals of care discussion within 72 hours. Given the potential severity, I think Evergreen just published their case series yesterday and described a 50% mortality rate for patients with COVID in ICU admissions. It's just being COVID positive and getting admitted to the hospital or admitted to the ICU, should that trigger a similar threshold, you know, given that how overwhelmed everybody is and the fact that it may take a couple of days to set things up? Like, should being COVID positive in the hospital trigger a preemptive goals of care discussion?
That's a really good question. I think that the goal, yes to the goals of care discussion, in my opinion, because there's a potential. We certainly are seeing people in their 30s and 40s who are getting very sick with COVID. So despite popular belief that it's mostly impacting older people, we are experiencing younger people getting really sick. And so I would say yes to goals of care, but I think reserving the palliative care consultations for those people who are in a particularly challenging situation so that we're not like overburdening that service, which I think, you know, most intensivists have excellent primary palliative care skills and can certainly provide that service.
So a different way to phrase that then is, I mean, we should probably take the same approach we take toward badly injured trauma patients. You know, like the primary ICU service should sit down and have a real discussion about goals in case things go the wrong way.
I would argue that probably the 72 hour market might be too long if we're expecting to be short on life-sustaining treatments. Ventilators are going to be in demand and manpower, that maybe this really does need to happen within the first 24 hours.
It's kind of just a side note, but I was just thinking of this. Katie, have you guys talked about, as far as performing tracheostomies on these patients, like early versus late, like have your practices changed at all? Or if these patients are in the medical, is the surgery team getting consulted to do trachs on these patients?
Yeah, that's a really great question. It actually hasn't come up yet for us. People are talking about that, like how are we going to deal with COVID positive people going to the operating room and the undoubtable impact that that's going to create for the operating room. We haven't hit that that roadblock yet.
Right. You know, I tend to do most of my trachs are perc trachs in the ICU if the patient's anatomy and vent settings are amenable to that. Although I'm wondering if in this population, the vent settings are not going to be amenable to a perc trach at all. But kind of thinking it through, is it more dangerous to be doing a perc trach or more dangerous to be doing an open trach, and who needs to be in the room? And just haven't read anything about that yet.
I had this conversation for the first time yesterday in the setting of a COVID positive patient who was on VV ECMO. And because our practice, at least for ECMO patients, is early trachs to facilitate mobility and recovery. And kind of our discussion, you know, and really for the first time, I felt like I was making actual patient care decisions that was driven by resource limitations, and specifically PPE limitations. You know, it's a very high, the aerosolization is a real risk, and we're very low on PAPRs, if not out of PAPRs. You know, and it was going to take, you know, you put three people in that room, right? Me, an anesthesiologist, and a nurse, all in PAPRs. And I think the other thing to think about is that the human resources, particularly of intensivists, are for real. You know, we have, if you start losing a bunch of intensivists to quarantine or to illness, like you start to run out of people kind of quickly.
Yeah, we've been talking about that amongst our group as well, because not only are we intensivists, but we're the trauma surgeons, we're the general right. surgeons, we're the ECMO mm-hmm. providers. And so if you start taking out our group, that leaves a huge gap in the services that we provide.
Indeed. I think it's been a real interesting discussion for us. And Red, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this too. We, you know, our ECMO group is shared between the surgeons, the palm critical care, and the anesthesia critical care. But obviously, you know, they're a third of us are trauma surgeons. And we had that same discussion, Katie. You know, if you go down a couple of trauma surgeons, like all of a sudden the trauma system for the entire state mm-hmm. or the entire city goes down.
Have you all made specific ECMO protocols based on COVID?
You know, I was actually up at midnight last night writing ours.
Tell us about it, Matt. That was not meant to be a leading question. Please tell us about it.
You know, it's really interesting. And this is, I am an optimist till the end. And I do think one of the fascinating things that I think has happened very rapidly is that hospital systems that have previously not wanted to share like systems level information are like actively sharing systems level information. So this is actually the work, I think, of Janelle Badgelak, who's at the UW. She's an emergency medicine doctor, a critical care doctor, and one of the leaders of their ECMO program is an ECMO education. She's put together, it's a regional dashboard of all of the hospitals in the Pacific Northwest that can provide ECMO. You know, it's us, it's Emmanuel, it's the UW, it's the children's hospitals. And basically to be like, we've got like 35 beds in the Pacific Northwest that can do this. And we're trying to design, and it's going to be a resource limited setting, right? So, and we want to use that resource to the people who are going to have the greatest degree of a good outcome, greatest chance of a good outcome. And it's going to, I think, come down to some moderately arbitrary age limitations. It's going to come down to people with significant or really increasingly any medical comorbidities are not going to be great candidates. People with other organ system failure are not going to be great candidates, but we're trying to make that decision for all of the ECMO programs in our region so that it's not like when referring hospital calls Harborview, they get a different answer than when they call OHSU, or that we're going to be competing for patients, but that like people get shunted different patients. We want to have the same set of contraindications, which are going to be much more restrictive than we usually do. But it's been fascinating, even within a week or two, like this group has formed and is really deciding on indications and contraindications that previously nobody ever would have agreed to or shared.
Mac, have you looked at, I was just reading earlier today, the New York State Task Force, like ventilator allocation guidelines. Have you looked at those?
Not in any detail, no.
They're just really well worth reading because they really do bring a lot of the like ethical principles into play and really try to make decisions based on these principles. Because, of course, one of the things that we worry about in a resource-limited setting is that those of advanced age are going to be, quote-unquote, discriminated against. And what does that mean for us as a society? It's just an interesting topic.
You know, Katie, as a intensivist and a palliative care doctor, these are going to be really stressful decisions for everybody to make. It's going to be tough on the patients, on the family, and it's going to be really tough on the physicians and the nurses. How do we support ourselves and our staff and our partners through this? Are we doomed to be broken?
You know, one of the things that I've been mindful of during this the past couple weeks is surgeons coping strategies with sort of like the changing landscape of our roles. So for instance, like in our group, there's a small number of us who are either at higher risk or are currently in a more vulnerable state, such as myself. I'm expecting in September.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So there have been changes that have been made to like our service schedule and our call schedules to reduce risk as much as possible for those few of us who are in that group. And speaking from experience, I think it is hard, especially for acute care surgeons. You know, we live every day to be a part of disaster solutions, essentially, mm-hmm. and to kind of be able to step back and allow other people to do the work right now is really, really tough. And so I think there is a component of like identity distress about oneself and one's role in society during this time, you know, trying to be mindful of that and trying to be supportive as possible for people. Are you seeing any of that in your groups?
I think kind of how we were talking about before, the trauma census has gone down so considerably. So I was just on the trauma service for 5 days. And I mean, I am never bored at work, but I just felt bored and kind of useless. And then I was saying this to you before, Mac, like, yet I wasn't very productive doing any other academic work. I just felt kind of anxious and stuck. And in preparing for this podcast, I thought a lot about, you know, what can I, as a someone who's been trained in palliative care and has a, you know, a background as a yoga teacher and really tries to be mindful, like, one, what could I do for myself? But two, like, this part of my job and my training is to like step up and be supportive of other people who I'm sure are feeling the same thing and maybe just aren't articulating it the same way as me. And so I was just thinking, like, if nothing else, trying to maintain some sort of positivity and love and light in this space is just really important. And just kind of holding space for everyone and what everyone's going through, I think is like at least one little thing that we can do.
Yeah, you know, it feels, I don't know if you guys feel this way, but we, you know, when you're waiting in the trauma bay and you can hear the sirens, you know, and you know that they're hypotensive and you're just like, come on. Like, just if this is going to happen, I almost just wanted to, I don't want people to be sick and I don't actually want our health system to collapse. But like, if it's going to happen, like, let's just get it going.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, like, I'm
waiting.
Tired,
it's awful.
Tired of talking about it. Just, we're wildly unprepared. Let's just go.
Yes.
I think that's the trauma surgeon in us.
Yes. I feel so understood right now.
I know, right? Ugh.
Our medicine colleagues may be feeling quite differently.
Exactly. Oh, gosh. You know, this just happened at our hospital, and I'd be really interested in your thoughts, both of you, actually. Our hospital, as many have instituted very severe visitor restrictions, probably the right thing to do from a public health perspective. But we had an elderly patient who was COVID positive with bad ARDS, and he died. And this was after a transition. It was after a goals of care discussion, and it was a planned transition to comfort-focused measures. But at the time of his death, he had one person in there in full PPE. I was sitting there watching this, and I was like, how are we going to deal with people dying in quarantine? because it runs contrary to everything else that we want to do around the time of death, providing comfort and normalcy and family presence. And we're just very clearly not going to be able to do that. Thoughts, considerations, advice?
Do you have a protocol, Matt, for or Mac, for that? Are people allowed to be at the bedside as long as they're in
PPE? Our hospital has said no visitors, period, except for children and people at the end of life can have one visitor, you know, but it's a person in, you know, a face mask and a shield and gloves and gown. And you know, otherwise, you try to get as many people in there at the time of death. It just runs against everything that we've been trying to do. And I worry that as the volume, if we're really going to see a surge here and the volume of deaths is going to increase, our ability as surgeons, intensivists, palliative care doctors to devote the time we need to these transitions is going to rapidly fall away.
One of the things that I thought about, Mac, when you were telling that story is maybe utilizing, this sounds sort of terrible, but telemedicine mm-hmm. capabilities for those cases. The other things that we do to help patients and families at the end of life, like playing their favorite music or potentially having spiritual care available, those small things to help kind of ease this transition. I don't know. Do you have thoughts, mm-hmm. Red?
I was thinking a couple of weeks ago when I was in the ICU, I was taking care of someone and we had three, she was dying and there were a lot of family members in the room, but we had three different cell phones on her chest with people there also talking to her and just like being present, and they were definitely in the room too. And so I think just as a society, we've become more comfortable. I've had a lot of people on cell phones at the end of life now, and just making sure that we can help facilitate that or making sure that everyone's on a group call that they can be there. I think we're just going to have to turn to that. It's mm-hmm. not as good, but it's something.
Yeah, we have this similar policies of no visitors at Harborview. They've gone as far as like barricading most of the entrances and exits to the hospital. What we're dealing with in the trauma ICU is folks who are approaching end of life and their family members can't be there. And that is so unbelievably frustrating for people. And so having family meetings and having Zoom or Skype or whatever FaceTime set up by the nurses, having pictures of family members in the room, all these things are becoming more and more important. And for us, we're trying to figure out all of these like telemedicine nuances that we've never really had to deal with before, like having family meetings over Zoom, which for palliative care providers, in my experience, it's been extra challenging because I really rely on like the emotional cues of the room and that like nonverbal feedback that you get from people. And a lot of that is lost. And so it does feel kind of clunky, but you know, we're doing the best we can.
I think that's what it's going to have to be. You know, like we're going to take all of these palliative care skills that we developed. You know, Katie's reference to respond to nonverbal and emotional cues, and we're going to have to add them in electronic communications. It's a whole very new, challenging skill set.
But I think, Katie, you used that word flexible, I think, twice mm-hmm. now. And I think that's what it's calling on all of us to be flexible. I think sometimes surgeons in general, sometimes our personalities are a little fixed. And I think that we're just going to all have to go with the flow a little bit more and just make it work. Mm-hmm. I want to shift a little bit because I was listening to a CAPC webinar yesterday, I think, and Diane Meyer, one of the things she said is we really need to make sure that in this time of COVID that the palliative care team does not just fall back into being the end of life team, that like palliative care has so many other things to offer. And so one thing I've been thinking about from my palliative care world is making sure that all of my patients, when they're leaving the hospital, have good advanced directives. And so I was wondering if we can maybe talk a little bit more. Have you guys been doing that? I try to be really careful on trauma when someone's going to discharging to any place other than home, that they're going if they need a DNR form or that their MOST form, that I've reviewed it and updated it with them. But, you know, certainly sometimes I'll let that, if I'm busy, that kind of falls off my to-do list, unfortunately. And I've noticed that I've just been being really vigilant to make sure that I'm talking to all of my patients, because my concern is that if, God forbid, they come back to the hospital and then their families can't visit them, that here we're left with these forms that they may or may not have.
Yeah, I'm really thankful that you're bringing this up, because I feel like it's something that I certainly need to start prioritizing more for our group. I think, you know, it's because it's a weakness that existed before this whole thing came out. And now sure. It's just, it's being elevated as such a huge priority. I think the challenge now is that for us, we've scaled back significantly in terms of like the floor manpower, right? So we don't have medical students anymore, and the residents are cut back. Time and resources are limited to have these in-depth conversations. But I know for people who are getting discharged to skilled nursing facilities here, they do have to have a pulse form, but you worry about the quality of those conversations being had.
Mac, have you seen any changes at OHSU?
I think the biggest change we've been dealing with is people, patients and their families are asking real legitimate questions about going home versus going to a SNF, you know, and when we have these discussions about leaving the hospital and returning to the hospital and pulse forms, you know, they rightly bring up that many of the major, you know, one of the major risks of going to a SNF now is contracting coronavirus. It's been an interesting discussion, you know, versus balancing going home with maybe some suboptimal care and knowing that there's a higher risk of returning to the hospital.
I've even noticed, just thinking more thoughtfully, I guess, about some of these geriatric trauma patients, like, do they really need to be admitted to the mm-hmm. hospital? You know, there's mm-hmm. so many people I just admit for OBS. I'm always trying to do shared decision-making, but really kind of asking the family too, like, what is your ability to tolerate risk, and which risk do you want to tolerate more? You know, mm-hmm. because that's a very personal decision.
It brings up the, what's the goal of this hospitalization question, much earlier than I've had to previously deal with mm-hmm. it. Yes. You know, because we do the same thing, right? You admit them, it's 2 o'clock in the morning and somebody's a ground level fall, like, we'll admit them and deal with it in the morning, you know?
Right.
But now it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you got to go down there and say, what are you trying to accomplish? How can we do this?
But Katie, I think it brings up what you said, how, you know, as a rather new attending, which we all are, making these decisions, they seem like very weighty decisions. And mm-hmm. they're sometimes a little uncomfortable to make. Like, there's no clear guidance.
Yeah, I agree. I think last week, what my experience was is that the majority of our new admits are older people who fall and then they have a bunch of rib fractures. That's pretty much almost like all we're seeing now, right?
Yep.
Shelter in place is working.
Yeah. In some aspects, I found these conversations almost a little bit easier within the context of COVID, because people do appreciate this risk. Whereas I think before, some people are like, well, I want to make sure everything is in tip top shape and my pain's control, everything is good. Whereas now the conversations I've had with regards to, you know, if things don't go the way we're hoping for, either you die in the hospital or you would need life supportive therapy, I'm finding that most people are like, nope, I'm not going to go down that route. And also they're totally on board with getting out of the hospital as soon as possible, you know, after having a frank discussion with them about their risks within the context of COVID.
As the PPE limitations become more severe, and the number of patients we're seeing with active COVID disease become more common, it seems inevitable that we're going to begin to have to take care of our colleagues. Mm-hmm. You know, I know there's been a couple physicians in the Seattle area that have contracted this and died. What, if anything, do we need to change about our approach for patients who are not only just physicians and nurses, but our colleagues and our friends?
Gosh, that's like,
I know, there's
the
no
worst
answer.
Question ever.
I know.
No one wants to think about it.
One of my colleagues was in a helicopter with a COVID positive patient for 3 hours a couple of days ago. You know, like, it's, I think it's going to be coming our way. The moral distress that's going to be associated with, I mean, ethically, we can't provide a different set of resource limitations to our friends and colleagues than we do to the rest of our patients, which means that we're going to have to apply the same set of resource limitation decisions to them that we would everybody else, arguably, right?
These conversations, because of what's been going on in Seattle, have been taking place. And I have heard people voice arguments for being a physician should count for something. We do give up a lot of our lives in order to do what we do. And should that count for something? You know, mm-hmm. So that's like another argument playing into this. But I think we're getting down to like, at what point are we shifting from prioritizing the well-being of individual people to prioritizing the well-being of like the greater good? And I think where we're at in Seattle is still, we're still treating the individual patient like we always would.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting to hear that you haven't shifted yet, because it sounds so awful there.
I feel like we haven't, because we're not, besides like the PPE issue, all of our masks are behind the OR desk and we can only get one per day and things like that. We still have ventilators available. Our blood supply is down because people are social distancing and people aren't donating as much, but we still have blood. So I think a lot of people are talking about it and thinking about, at what point are we going to shift to having to change this focus of prioritizing public health?
Then there was just a Jerry Powell podcast on this yesterday that was incredible. I'm forgetting their two names, but they're both physicians who do a lot of bioethics. And, you know, one of them was talking about the fact that when the country declares a state of emergency and the state that you're living in declares a state of emergency, that the ethics really shift away from a more personal ethics, like the way we usually think about medicine, and to a more public health ethics, and that those ethics are different. And I mean, they kind of went through the whole ethical framework of how we make decisions and quoted several different articles that were written in the last decade about how we allocate resources. But one of them made the point that the reality is we need to be thinking and talking about this right now, because we are going to be faced with these decisions. Certainly, there's some frameworks that may value physicians over others, and there's frameworks that may value younger people over older people, but that we need to kind of agree on some sort of framework so that we are trying as best as we can to take the subjectiveness out of it. And so that if you go to a place like OHSU or you come to me in Asheville, that we're making the same sort of decisions. And that's mm-hmm. certainly a way to help decrease the moral distress of us as physicians, is that we have some sort of framework to think about this rather than, oh, this is my hunch and this is how it's going to be.
Yeah, it sounds like what they're experiencing in Italy is they're really going through this right now without yes. having sort of like a framework to go off of. And that's just causing a lot of distress for mm-hmm. the people making these decisions.
What's interesting is the Society of Critical Care Medicine just released their guidelines for the management of critically ill patients with coronavirus. You know, even in these excellent guidelines that they managed to put together in the last couple of weeks, there's nothing about resource allocation, which to me, it's such an issue. So again, we're asked to be on the forefront of this, and there's really, unfortunately, not a lot of guidance.
It's true. And I think that as palliative care minded people, a lot of other folks think that, well, you must do ethics as well.
Mm-hmm. But that is not true.
It's not true. Right. So yeah. The assumption is that if you have palliative care interest or palliative care training, that you totally are into ethics. And it's not true. Well, while I do think, though, that palliative care people should be involved in these ethical discussions for all the reasons that we've talked about, and they should be at the table.
Yeah, I don't think we are the ones making the decisions. I think where we can best serve everyone is supporting people through their moral distress. I mean, mm-hmm. I think we're really good at listening and holding space and helping people to normalize whatever feelings they're feeling. But there was something I was reading either from AAHPM or on some palliative care web made it clear palliative care physicians should not be being called to make these ethical decisions. Mm-hmm. Unless you have another year of training or some special interest in ethics, that's not really within our realm. But again, I'm thinking of my own hospital. I think we have one person on the ethics committee right now. The palliative care people are the next people who are going to be called inevitably.
Right. Yeah.
Katie, I think your framework of switching from care of the individual patient to care of the population is a really fascinating and important framework, because it seems like the palliative care mission is going to switch from care of the individual patient to care of the team, right? And how do we make mm-hmm. sort of, as you mentioned, like support the primary team, not only in the care of their patients, but if we're really going to be at this for weeks and months and not burning ourselves out or minimizing the amount that we're going to be burning ourselves out.
True. And I think a lot of that has to do with what we're doing now. So like Mac, I can see you're at home. I'm at home. Mm-hmm. You know,
I'm at home.
And Red's at home.
In my PJs.
which for surgeons is so hard. It's like counterintuitive to like everything that we do. In reality, we're trying to preserve our man force so that when people do start getting sick, there's reinforcements.
Katie, anything else you want to add as someone who's more on the forefront than the rest of us right now? Any other lessons learned or thoughts? Anything you wish you knew a couple of weeks ago that you know now that you can pass on to us?
I feel like the key to this is going to be having each group, wherever you practice, needs to have like some sort of palliative care minded person. And that for that person to be able to step up and really focus on all of the things that we've talked about today on the podcast. A lot of my colleagues, such as Mac and other fellows that have come after him, have now gotten jobs all across the nation. The younger generation of surgeons tend to be the people, even if they don't have palliative care fellowships, they are the go-to people in their own place for these palliative care related topics, trainings. And a lot of them have reached out to me in terms of, hey, I'm thinking about doing this journal club, or we're putting together this protocol for COVID. Like, what are you guys doing? And so I'm really encouraged by that. That there are younger surgeons that are sort of stepping into this role. And I think this is an opportunity to really ramp up, take ownership of that role as like the surgical palliative care person in your group.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that.
I mean, Katie, you're totally right. There's a couple of these like pillars of surgical palliative care in the older generation of surgeons. And then there's this huge army of us who have been trained by them and really, you know, can't be more than 5 or 6 years into practice.
Right.
You know, it's our time. It's our time to seize it as millennials. Hashtag millennials.
it just reminds me of why we might not have the insight yet into how to be on these huge committees that are deciding upon hospital protocols at this time. We really can be important members of our department, both supporting the patients and making sure that every patient leaving has these advanced directives, making sure that if these family meetings aren't getting done by the palliative care team, that we're stepping in with our extra time and doing these family meetings, making sure that our colleagues feel supported so that we do bring something important to the table, even if we're younger in our careers.
Absolutely.
Yeah, indeed.
Well, I appreciate so much your time, Mac. Thank you again. You're my awesome co-host.
Well, it's wonderful, and Red.
Katie, it was so awesome to finally get to meet you and to chat with you. And I'm so appreciative of your time during this busy time in your life. And I just wish all of you guys at Harborview and in Seattle, I'm just sending you all my love.
Thank you so much for
Likewise.
Having me.
Yeah.
All right, you guys, hang in there.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Stay healthy.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on the latest episodes. To learn more about the surgical palliative care community, follow us on Twitter @SurgePalCare. If you'd like to get more involved with the Surgical Palliative Care social media team, please reach out on Twitter or via email at surgicalpalliativecare@gmail.com. Lastly, take good care of yourselves and take good care of each other.